Hello, I'm Rillian.
And this is Glumpuddle.
And you're listening to the Silver Chair Discussion on the Narnia Web Podcast.
Oh, if only we knew, said Jill.
I think we do know, said Puddle Glum.
Do you mean you think everything will come right if we do untie him? Said Scrub.
I don't know about that, said Puddle Glum.
You see, Aslan didn't tell Pole what would happen. He only told her what to do.
We had been intending to finish the Silver Chair in this episode,
but due to the fact that's not going to happen, I'm pretty sure. That's not possible, because we're from Narnia Web, so...
Yeah, and we've received a whole bunch of questions, and you know, we won't always be able to answer all the questions. We answer as many as we can.
Right.
But even the ones we are going to answer, we're not going to even answer all of them in this episode. We're going to save some for the next one.
Right.
So where do we leave off, Rillian?
Well, they escaped the giants.
They did, avoided being eaten. And they slid down, and there's and Jill says she's terribly thirsty, and then there's that really long silence, which they probably couldn't quite know how much time had passed. And then, "What make you hear creatures of the overworld?"
Is how hey, I that's kind of pretty good.
It. Yeah, that's kind of how I think of it. I always think of it as sort of a whisper, these voices. And it's a really cool cliffhanger ending to a chapter. You have to keep reading after that to find out who said that and what it means.
I kind of think it's just, you know, that kind of sound where someone can say something. You get this more, you probably had more time in settings like this, sound studios, where there's not a lot of reverberation in the voice because the sound is absorbed in the surroundings.
Uh-huh.
I imagine a voice kind of like that. There's no echoey substance. It's kind of just a very dead sound to the voice.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of ends once you finish speaking.
Yeah. I love the characters of the gnomes and the way Lewis describes how incredibly different that they are in the variety of some have 10 toes, some have no toes, some have sharp noses, some have crook noses,
mm-hmm.
some have tails and some don't. That was always one that weirded me out the most. But then the fact that everyone looks so sad and we have no idea why. And we're going to find out later it's because they're not really at their true home, but we'll get to that.
For the purpose of the story, they're villains, you know, right off the bat. Anyway.
For now, yeah, they're villains.
For now, they're villains. And I like it because you don't usually have villains where the first reaction that the people being captured by them or whatever is they feel sorry for them.
Yeah, it kind of has it. Even Puddleglum says, "Wow, if these chaps don't take me to take a serious view of life, I don't know what will."
Yeah. Nope, I was just looking at our question about the gnomes.
Yep, so we've got, you want to go ahead and read that from Waga Werewolf? Sorry if I'm not quite saying that right. I think it's Waga Werewolf 27?
I think so.
I actually got an email explaining how to say it.
Yeah, but we need an audio question. An audio explaining how to pronounce it.
Finally
so
say it.
That'll, but anyway, she says, "The travelers slide down a slope and the racket must have sent off an alarm for the Earthmen. Even so, given the long time it took to reach the underground city afterwards, wouldn't you think the Earthmen would have had a permanent guard post at that point, or any other hole? Or was there another nearby entrance for Lady of the Green Kirtle and the Black Knight to exit to Overland when they wanted to ride their horses?"
So, I don't know. We don't know, and the characters probably don't know either, how long they just sat there in the dark. It could have been hours. It could have been, you know, maybe only 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Here's
the thing. It's obviously not a road.
No.
That people
or
take
not
up.
What we would call
I get
road,
the idea that it was a little chink in the earth where they, and again, this was Aslan told them to try to do what the writing said, and
underneath.
They find their way down underneath. I get the idea that there are probably multiple little areas where people could slip down, and this is just the one that they found, and that, yeah, if the knight and if Rillian and the Queen were to go up, especially on horseback, they were going to use probably a small exit that was prepared.
They probably would have used a road that wasn't so difficult to, because you don't get the sense that they could have gotten back out of that entrance
exactly
if they wanted to. You know, many fall down and few return to the sunlit lands. They're chaps of one
idea.
As opposed
to, you're the first to have fallen down. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not saying that they have a whole section of people somewhere who've fallen down and won't return, but I'm just saying that it's like,
So I don't know. My thinking is that it probably was an hour or so. That's kind of how I always, always imagine it. And honestly, I kind of imagine like maybe one person seeing them, and then maybe there was some one person nearby that heard them and went to go get, you know, a group of them.
Well, here's the thing. As Pippin learned in The Fellowship of the Ring, the movie Pippin, not the...
Even the book, it took
a little longer in the book because it's a book. When you make a clamor down a hole,
someone's gonna hear it,
and then people are gonna come. They're gonna be armed. It's something that happens in dark.
It wouldn't surprise me if they heard it from afar. But I think I always kind of imagine there was one person. And remember, they're all so sad and kind of stoic. I imagine there's one guy standing right there, and they fall down like right next to him, and he just kind of looks at him. It's like, oh. I guess I'll go get some guards or something. And he kind of wanders off and goes and gets some. That's kind of always what I had in my head, I think.
Do you remember, what were your thoughts on, like, just when you were reading, experiencing Underworld as a reader, what did you think of it? I thought it was fascinating.
It's not, at this point in the story, we're just thinking, escape, 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 get away from the dogs, right. Get away from the giants, go, go, go. And we're not really expecting this whole other thing to start as a result of that, I think. I hadn't thought far enough ahead. I guess I probably should have thought, oh, they're going underground, of course, but I really didn't. I was really absorbed in, get away from the giants, just run away. And so, it's sort of out of the frying pan into the fire. Okay, they escaped the giants, but then this whole other, you know, thing they have to figure out starts up.
No, I was just thinking about all the things they find, whether it's the lake, the Father Time, the city.
I love the Sunless Sea. To me, that's one of the most evocative scenes in the series. Of just this, and this is something that I really hope they can capture in the movie, is the disorientation of they're on there for so long. I guess I'm getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but they're on the sea for so long that it starts to feel like they've always been on there.
You
don't know if I've been asleep for 5 minutes or an hour.
I have a quick question for you. I went into a cave in 2011, I think. Down in Alabama, and have you ever been in a cave with no light sources whatsoever?
We're absolute pitch black in a
cave? Absolute nothing.
I don't think I have.
It is an experience. I mean, it's when you get to the so dark where closing your eyes and opening them gives you no visual
difference
whatsoever, it is something.
Wow.
It's just a very different feeling.
And that's something that, you know, it's funny how often in books that kind of world is described, but in the movie they can never quite honor that because then it becomes a radio drama.
Yeah, and the closest you ever got, it's like you know, the Emperor's New Groove where they're locked in the closet of Yzma's eyes and then Kronk's eyes, you know, back.
Right. But I do hope in the movie they try to keep it as dark as possible. I would like to keep just have torchlight, not really show much, and that would really create a sense of just being cut off from everything you've ever known, to just not see really anything. He maybe hear a lot of things, but not see anything outside of that outside of the few feet of the torchlight. I think would be really evocative. So I hope they go for as dark as they can in the movie. But there's all kinds of little interesting things here. The warden tells them to march, and they start marching. And, by the way, this is another reason Pelagon's my favorite character. I love how you would think he, of all people, would be listing all the reasons they should be afraid, all the reasons why this is terrible, but he's actually not. He's actually, now that they're in the darkness of Underland, now that they seem to be in the worst place they could be, this is when Puddleglum is their biggest source of encouragement. And I really admire that.
He reminds the reader, too. Because the reader's kind of thinking out of the frying pan into the
fire. Oh, yeah.
And then they realize, oh, well, I guess they're doing the right thing.
But there's all kinds of interesting things they come across, like all the different animals and plants and weird stuff. You know, many fall down, few return to the sunlit lands. But probably the most interesting is Old Father Time.
I did not see that coming.
Well, how could you possibly see that, something like that coming?
He kind of, like, even Father Christmas kind of makes sense, because once you hear it's Christmas, you think, oh, there's going to be some kind of tie into our world, you know, with Lionel's the wardrobe. But here you think, wait, what?
Yeah, and let me actually read that part. So Puddleglum asks who that is, and the warden says, that is Old Father Time, who was once a king in Overland, and now he has sunk down into the deep realm. And wait, you know what? You're the one people like to hear read Narnia. Let me have you read this bit.
Okay. That is old Father Time, who was once a king in Overland, said the warden. And now he has sunk down into the deep realm, and lies dreaming of all the things that are done in the upper world. Many sink down and few return to the sunlit lands. They say he will awake at the end of the world.
I think what this is like, you know, just where, you know, in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, we were talking about how things get weirder and weirder as they go along. And you find the more further east you go, the closer to the end of the world you get, the more things you come across that are so difficult to understand. They're so unlike things that we're familiar with. And so I think when they're the same, it's kind of true for the bottom of the world, where it's so far removed mm-hmm. from our familiar world, it's not surprising to come across things that you've never even imagined could exist.
Exactly.
And actually, Rose Tree Dryad had a really interesting question/theory.
Very
about
interesting
this.
Question.
Hi, Narnia Web podcasters. In the chapter Travels Without Sun, Jill, Eustace, and Puddleglum are being led down into Underland, and they encounter a sleeping giant. The warden tells them that this is Old Father Time, that he was once a king in Overland, and that he will wake at the end of the world. Later in this chapter, after they've met Rillian, they're told that Under Me was originally part of a longer message. Though under Earth and throneless now I be, yet while I lived, all Earth was under me. Rillian says that it's clear the message was written to memorialize some king of giants who lived in the ancient past. Anyway, I reread the book recently, and it occurred to me that Father Time may well have been the giant that the message was written about. This also wouldn't have been a boastful statement, but rather a statement of fact, given that Father Time literally blots out the sun in the last battle. Clearly, he had a great deal of physical power over the universe of Narnia. Anyway, I don't know if it's true, but it's an interesting thought to ponder.
So you read it, and yes, does actually say he was once a king in Overland, but now he's sunk down. So he's under Earth and throneless, but while he lived, all Earth was under him.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
I don't know why I'd never thought of it before.
Never even occurred to me.
It had not occurred to me at all, but I think it's very possible. Especially, he is a giant right there, and there was a ruined city of the giants. And I think it, I always liked... I do not want to be too harsh on the BBC movies, but I did feel like it kind of damaged my imagination, because I just finished the book the other day, and
Silver Chair, you mean?
Going through the Silver Chair again, and I was imagining a ruined city of giants. How massive would that be? Even just a ruined city, and I think, oh my goodness! And then, you know, of course, there it's just I don't even remember really. It was just this, lame little thing, someone did. But I mean, that must have been incredibly massive. And I just think about the scale of a giant city, and of course you have Harfang, but that's one castle, not a city. And you just think about how much, what kind of a civilization that was. I really wonder. I think it's very possible. I don't know why I'd never. We don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if Lewis, put that in there just, and really was thinking, hey, maybe this, maybe he was saying,
it's
the king that it was talking
Father
about.
Time. Obviously time. That's something that's. A concept that's relevant to, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as Rose pointed out, clearly he has a lot of power. He's able to blot out the sun and everything at the end in the last battle.
Well, and let me read what Rillian says. Though under earth and throneless now I be, yet while I lived, all earth was under me. And he says, from which it is plain that some great king of the ancient giants who lies buried there caused this boast to be cut in the stone over his sepulchre.
And so it does seem like Father Time could conceivably... I never thought of Father Time as a giant, per se. Yes, a very big person.
Right.
But I never thought of him as being of that race, but I suppose he could be. So, I guess so. There's not much else to say. Yeah, there's not much else to say about it. Like, I wish we could say more about it. Really appreciate the observation, Rose.
And yeah, I appreciate the observation. I'll read it. Look at it differently from now on. I mean, and yeah, as far as answering your question, obviously we don't know, but I certainly would say it has. I think your theory has a lot of credence to it.
I'll definitely look into it more. And it's interesting. It's just in the same way that, you know, the underground army is under Narnia at any moment could break out and they have no idea. I think the fact that, you know, the end of the world is coming, you know, it's a scientific fact that things have to come to an end sooner or later, however many millions of years it takes, sooner or later, you know, the sun's going to go out and things have to come to an end and run their natural course. So the fact that you have Father Time underneath the world, just waiting to come out and put the world to an end, it's going to happen eventually. I just think that's a really powerful image. He's under there and no one even thinks about the fact that he's under there, waiting to come out and put the world to an end.
We reach the city, and of course they're going to go to the dungeon, and then Rillian hears that their upworld is there, and so he summons them.
He's simply called the Black Knight at this point.
Yeah, he's the Black Knight, not the Monty Python version. It's a new flesh wound! Sorry. But I think that this whole section of the book is fascinating because obviously I mean the reader's kind of going you know,
got to be Rillian.
Yeah, when they meet Rillian. But
immediately, like especially at this point in the book, who else could it possibly
right.
be?
And of course also, you know, like they probably thought I'm sure that you know beautiful woman who told him to go to Harfang, that's got to be the serpent, you know.
When you meet her on the road.
Yeah, even Eustace and Jill at the Parliament of Owls put 2 and 2 together. Oh well, I'll bet that serpent and that witch and the woman were the same person. You know, just boom. Oh, I'm sure they're the same person. Just
so a lot of the major apparent twists in the Silver Chair are pretty obvious.
Right, but I think what's interesting here, and again, it kind of goes back to a point I've made in the past, where sometimes, you know, a lot of books or movies or plays, stories focus the suspense on the big reveal or what happens next. But sometimes it's not even a what is happening, but a how is this happening. Sometimes that's a different angle of suspense that Lewis definitely likes to play with.
It always makes me think of, I'm going to get it wrong, but there's a Hitchcock quote where he basically said, you know, two people are, if you have a scene where you have two people having a normal conversation and all of a sudden a bomb goes off, you know, that's shocking, sure. But, okay, let's do the same scene, but now at the beginning of the scene, the camera pans down and we see there's a bomb about to go off under them. Mm-hmm. Now we have suspense, you know, suspense, as Hitchcock talked about it, came from, we know things that the characters don't know. And I think that's a lot of what the Silver Chair is.
Well, I think and it's fascinating because then, of course, there's the question, because the audience is thinking, this must be the Lost Prince. Why is he talking like this? The witch isn't there. He seems to believe what he's saying. Why does he believe what he's saying? Oh, there must be an enchantment. Well, how do they get him out of the enchantment?
Yes, so there's still a lot of questions. About how is this all going to go down? And are the characters going to have the courage to do what they need to do? I think it's kind of by the time you get to the Silver Chair is the question.
Right.
Like, and that's you know, something like, I think. We knew going to Harfang, as readers, we knew going to Harfang was a terrible idea.
Right.
And we knew there were going to be consequences for it. And
right.
so
but
it's more of a, oh my gosh, what have they gotten themselves into?
But
how are
they
going to get out
of it? That is some of the suspense is. And I like how Hitchcock said it, and that's what the BBC version didn't get, where they put a mask on the actor and gave him a beard and mustache, and it's, okay, we must, I guess the author thought the audience wouldn't have figured it out by this point, so we obviously, since we're doing a movie and you can see the face, we have to cover it up, because I guess the audience isn't supposed to know right now.
Oh, you can cover up his face all you want. It's just that at this point in the story, when you spend this much time on the backstory and learning about all these details of who this character
right.
is, come on, you know, there's only one reason he'd be doing that, is if he's someone really important. I do understand, I can see where maybe where this is something that might work better in a book than in a movie, because I think the tone of, you know, the narrator's kind of a character in Narnia, And he has a certain tone, like when the characters are going to Harfang, he can say, you know, that they never really thought about Prince Rillian anymore. Right. All they thought about was Hot Baths. And he has this tone where he, like, the narrator is agreeing with you as a reader, yeah, these characters are making a bad decision. Right. And that's much more difficult, I think, to do in a movie, to have, you know, a storyteller be a character.
Yeah.
So I think you'd be getting annoyed with them. I can't believe they're doing this. This is so obvious. You know, in a book, the narrator can agree with you. Yeah, I know it's a bad idea. Yeah, but yeah. In the movie, I'm not sure you can really do that as effectively. So I wonder, maybe this is something where in the movie they do need to try to see if they can make it more of a surprise when it's revealed to be him. I think that might work better for a movie.
I think that Lewis makes a very unique choice here. Very frequently, there are characters in stories. Well, sometimes you have a character that's annoying. But usually when the character is annoying, it's annoying to another character. They're rarely annoying to the reader. And really in here is actually, I was just going through the other day, I thought, man, I just don't like him. The dialogue and stuff, it's very annoying in some ways. And of course, it's annoying to the characters as well. So it has this kind of double impact of, okay, yes, I get that it's annoying to this character. No, I'm annoyed with it too, but I get that this is supposed to be the prince.
Right. And then he starts trying to... but then after that, just being annoying, he really tries to give them a good kick in the stomach and tell them that, no, those words meant nothing to you. Mm-hmm. It was all just a coincidence. You know, that was just just part of a larger verse. And the characters really are affected by it. And... gee, I wonder who comes to the rescue? It's Puddleglum, who says, you know, don't you mind him. There are no accidents. Our guide is Aslan, and he was there when the Giant King caused the letters to be cut, and he knew already all things that would come of them, including this.
You can insert your applause, your crowd applause at this point if you want.
Puddleglum is the hero. People can talk about him as a gloomy character all they want, but he is such a wonderful source of hope and such a reminder to them of... why they should continue to hope, even though things really seem to be at their worst point. So that's one of the reasons I reject this notion of Puddleglum just being a gloomy character.
Do you think, for the movie, do you think that they'll be able to keep the dialogue of Rillian, this very, I'll say, high speak?
It's a long dialogue. Oh, the way he talks?
The manner in which he talks. Do you think they'll be able to keep it for the movie?
I don't know. I mean, I hope so. They haven't really generally been faithful to that in the first few movies. Like when you think about, obviously, just the way the children talk, they didn't really stay true to that. Like you don't really hear them say, "By Jove," or "Trumpkin, you're a brick," or stuff like that.
And even
Trumpkin, you know, bids and bids. Yeah, I know they threw a few in there, but generally, Trumpkin doesn't really talk the way he does in the book. So my guess is, if we're gonna look at the first few movies as precedent, they probably wouldn't.
They could pull it off. There's a question of choice, whether they would want to, and the question of capability without making it sound stupid. There are some actors who can say it. I don't know if you've ever watched a Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare film, but some actors are able to speak lines of dialogue like that in Shakespeare and stuff, and it just sounds like the way they talk. It doesn't sound like they're reciting it. It sounds like they're just like that's just them. Some actors can pull it off.
Right.
Some actors cannot.
So you don't think, oh, this is Shakespeare. It's just the way he talks, and you don't question it.
So if they wanted to do that, they could, but it would limit their choice of actors, I'm going to say.
Yeah. They really got to find
I think you're right.
Rillian.
I think they will probably not.
Rillian is one of those, I think, one of those minor roles. That's a really intriguing role for an actor. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those small roles you could see getting Academy Award attention. I'm not saying that I would expect that to happen with this.
Right.
But it's just one of those little roles that's, as an actor, wow, what a really interesting character to play this whole dynamic of, well, first I'm playing the fake him that he thinks is the real him, but now I'm playing the real him people think is fake, and then having to give you, the viewer, the sense of all the hurt and pain he has experienced, and that whole transformation scene where he becomes sane again. Yeah. Like it's a small role, but obviously a crucial one in the story. A really interesting one for an actor to play. I think an actor would have a lot of fun with that.
I think so too. There's very few roles out there where someone is this big a part of the story and would have that small amount of time in the story.
So we're at chapter 11, and we finally reached it. Here we are, the silver chair. It's finally in the story.
Did you see this? I think it's such an interesting. I was thinking about the title. I think it's such an interesting title. You just have no clue. It's just, that is the bomb. You know, two people having a conversation, then the bomb goes off. Boom! There's the silver chair. Oh.
Uh huh. Yeah. Where it's like, you know, the silver chair's got to come in at some point. And in that case, if for some reason you still haven't figured out that this is the prince, well, now it's pretty obvious. Okay, he's in. This character is in the silver chair. The title of the book. He must be really, really important.
You know. Yeah. Pretty much.
But it's funny, you know, like he kind of explained this when he was sort of explaining the nature of this enchantment. And this is something that Waggle Werewolf asked about. Just another question sent in. Just details about how does this enchantment work? Why is it necessary to bind Prince Rillian to the silver chair when he's in his unenchanted state? And why is he enchanted after dinner? And does plain ordinary food, you know, neutralize the enchantment? Maybe is something Wagga asks. What are your general thoughts on that? On why they had this whole werewolf thing, or sort of reverse werewolf, I guess, where at night he becomes normal, and presumably the silver chair is part of the enchantment because it ends when it's destroyed.
Right. Well, he says, I think he says, the hour is soon upon me. You don't really get a very good idea of how long it is.
How long what is?
How long his moment of sanity is.
That's true.
I almost get the idea it is an hour.
Let me see.
I'm trying to find it here.
No. Now the frenzy is beginning, blah, 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 blah.
My thoughts are...
If only we knew...
First of all, I think it's put in there to be probably just a fascinating...
Study. Hang on.
The reading of the silver chair by Glumpuddle, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay. He says, so when he's in the chair, he says, quick, I am sane now. Every night I am sane. If only I could get out of this enchanted chair, it would last. I should be a man again. But every night they bind me, and so every night my chance is gone. So I guess it's not necessarily the entire night. It could just be an hour.
Yeah. That was my, obviously the hour is upon us, you know, means more than...
Yeah, it doesn't mean an hour.
It doesn't just mean an hour.
We don't know how long it lasts.
I actually kind of get the idea that it
wasn't. Why is it? Like, did the queen's enchantment... Should she have, you know, waved her wand? Well, we don't know if she has a wand, but should she have just tried a little bit harder and maybe get it to last 24/7 instead of just every night?
Here's a possibility. What if when she first captures him... What if she puts him in the chair for a long period of time, and then eventually, it's like as time has gone on, let's say at the beginning, the majority of his time was in the chair and he was sane, and then he'd have these brief periods where he was in captivity, so to speak, when he was set him loose.
Uh-huh.
And now it's been so long that the only period of his day is a brief hour. Or so.
So maybe eventually it's going to get to the point to where it is 24/7.
That's my thought.
I think I always assumed that if he ever became king, that if he, like, you know, the tyrant king of Narnia that the witch intends him to be, presumably, that it would last forever, that would be the mm-hmm. thing. And I can't necessarily find any support in the book for that, but I've always just kind of assumed that would be the final piece, that would make it forever. And so I always thought that would be the thing. But that's interesting what you're saying. If maybe, yeah, the sane moments are becoming shorter and shorter as the years have gone on.
I'm telling you, man, I predict. I'm just going to say it right now. I predict that the actor they choose for Rillian will have an extensive background in theater.
Yeah.
Likely Shakespeare in the West End. I'm just predicting.
All right. Heard it here first, guys.
Look at the people who are playing Hamlet right now. Just mm-hmm. saying. He's kind of crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well,
okay.
All right. Well, here we are. This is the moment we're about to get to the fourth sign. And why don't you go ahead and read that bit?
I see. I feel like I should be yelling this as I read it, but I won't.
Well, do it.
Seriously?
I dare you.
Okay.
Go for it.
Really, Glumpuddle has
hold yourself to the standard you want to hold the actor that plays really into. Let's get a taste of what... You playing really might have sounded
okay,
like.
Okay, I would, but honestly, it's kind of late at night, and I have people in the next like
Oh, fine.
The next part of the duplex. So
okay, but maybe in the next episode we can get the true
Yeah, I won't raise my voice that high. Cunning, isn't he? Said Puddleglum. Once and for all, said the prisoner, I adjure you to set me free. By all fears and all loves, by the bright skies of Overland, by the great lion, by Aslan himself, I charge you. Oh, cried the three travelers as though they had been hurt. It's the sign, said Puddleglum. It's the words of the sign, said Scrub more cautiously. Oh, what are we to do? Said Jill.
So there it is. You know, they've muffed the first three signs, and they dare muff the fourth. And to me, this is the real suspense of the book. It's not, what happened to Rillian and the mystery of Rillian? Mm-hmm. And are they going to find him? It's, no, they found him. But are they going to have the courage to actually trust that Aslan's signs really are trustworthy? Which to me is what Jill's whole emotional journey is about. Here's the moment. Is she going to go ahead and just trust... even though she's has never had anyone, at least for a long time, as far as we can see, anyone she can trust. Certainly no one in a position of authority that she can trust and really turn to. Now that her life is on the line, can she actually just trust that, no, Aslan's signs, you can just follow them and trust that one way or another you're going to be okay? And this is where I think you have another one of the great lines in the book, of the series, and why Puddleglum's my favorite character. It's just in this moment... Puddleglum says, Aslan didn't tell Pol what would happen. He only told her what to do. And they actually says, that fellow will be the death of us. Once he's up, I shouldn't wonder, but that doesn't let us off following the sign. So Puddleglum is not saying, I trust that if we set him free, he's not going to kill us. He says, no, even if he kills us, which I think he will, I'm just going to trust that somehow Aslan's going to make it work out anyway. What an incredible level of trust that is. I think that's such a great example for Jill, who's lost the ability to do that.
It's not like it's just, you're a Marshwiggle. Oh my goodness. Well, guess what? I'm really in everyone. You're from Narnia, right? Well, yeah. Just get me out of this chair. You know. I mean, he's really frantic.
Yeah.
And so I think that will kind of play into the what you were just talking about. It's not the question isn't what will happen because they found the lost prince. The audience knows that. The question is how is this going to play out?
Yeah, and I just think, are the characters actually going to have the courage, even though we've known for a while, this is really, and okay, now the characters know, what are they going to do with it? To me, that's the main source of tension in the book.
Mm-hmm. So then, of course, they do make the right decision.
Yep.
Rillian is freed. And
thanks to Puddleglum, the hero of the book, mm-hmm. they make the right decision. If he hadn't been there, they probably would have just said, okay, nope, we're leaving, and who knows what would have happened. Wait, so before we move on to this, I just want to hear you read maybe Rillian's, one of his most famous lines.
Oh, so you have heard of Narnia after all, said Jill. Had I forgotten it when I was under the spell, asked the knight. Well, that and all other bedevilments are now over. You may well believe that I know Narnia, for I am Rillian, Prince of Narnia, and Caspian the Great King is my father.
Epic, epic, epic. That's one line they have to do, I think, basically word for word in the movie.
True. Oh, absolutely.
Gotta get that right. But it's just in this moment of joy where things are finally looking up again and the quest seems to be complete that the villain now fully, if there was any doubt before, fully revealed to be the villain, pretty much at this point, walks in, the Lady of the Green Kirtle.
Did you see that coming?
That she was going to walk in at mm-hmm. that moment? No, I mean, I was really caught up
Everything's moving pretty quickly at this point.
Yeah, I was really caught up in, oh, it's really in finally the end of the quest, and I was really focused on that. I think that she was sort of temporarily off my radar.
Mm-hmm.
And like you were talking at the beginning of this episode, we know very little, or we're really only given a couple little hints really? About her origin. We don't really know where she came from, even what her full purpose is. We'll talk more about what her plan and mm-hmm. what it might be in the next episode, but... we actually got a audio question about this.
Hello, this is Jesus Aslan Freak. My question is whether or not you guys think the White Witch and the Lady of the Green Kirtle are somehow blood related. As in, is the Lady of the Green Kirtle the White Witch's daughter, or something like that? And if so, does that mean that the Lady of the Green Kirtle ate from the silver fruit that the White Witch ate in the end of the Magician's Nephew? After all, if they are somehow blood-related, then the Lady of the Green Kirtle has been around for over 1,300 years, and her face does turn white at one point when she lets her guard down. And I just wanted to know you guys' thoughts on that. Thanks.
So the Lady of the Green Kirtle having some relation to the White Witch of some kind, that's something that at the Parliament of Owls is kind of brought up, and it's not quite clear what they mean by one of the same crew. Mm-hmm. Like, do they mean just like, oh, a witch? You know, that's kind of like how the White Witch was a witch.
Yeah.
Is that all they mean? Or do they actually mean they could be related in some way?
Right.
If you take the backstory from, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't think they can't be the same person. We actually got a question from David about that. I mean, that would mean that the prophecy in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was not actually fulfilled, and also that Aslan tried to kill her and failed. I reject both of those ideas, obviously.
Yeah.
And as for the bit that Jesus Aslan Freak talks about where the Lady of the Green Kirtle's face turned white for a second, I definitely don't think that's supposed to imply any kind of connection to the White Witch. And this is just, let me just read it quick, that the Lady of the Green Kirtle walks in and sees Rillian free and sees the Silver Chair destroyed and everything, and Lewis writes, "She turned very white, but Jill thought it was the sort of whiteness that comes over some people's faces, not when they are frightened, but when they are angry." So I think that's just meant to convey how shocked and furious Lady of the Green Kirtle is about what just happened. It's not meant to imply any kind of connection to the White Witch. But what do you think? What do you think they mean by one of the same crew? And is it possible there's some kind of connection?
As far as are they part of the same crew, I'm gonna say yes and no. Depending on what sense of the word you take it to mean.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Yes, they're part of the same crew in that if you want to talk about the same crew being really powerful.
Well, you know, they're both witches, and they both have plots to take over Narnia.
They are both witches with plots to take over Narnia. They are, I'm going to say, they're powerful entities of evil. In a very real way, Tash and the White Witch are part of the same crew. So as far, and of course, yes, there is the witch link. You know, they're both these beautiful women with plans to not just really destroy Narnia, but rule Narnia. So you could say that there is that link of, obviously, they have that in common, and not just in common, like, oh, there's just one more villain, you know, like the next episode has another villain, this next episode has another villain for people to defeat.
Uh-huh.
There's actually, I think, more in the world of Narnia, because of how the power of good is unified, I think that in the universe of Narnia, just the power of evil, even if that entity doesn't necessarily think of it that way, is more unified as evil,
I mean,
trying
what
to destroy Narnia.
I'm trying to look at this from the owls' perspective.
Sure.
And what would the owls mean? They obviously don't know about the witch's plot or anything like that. So when this owl says we fear they might be part of the same crew, well, what's their perspective? Well, we see this witch that seems to have some kind of magical powers, and we fear that she has some great plot against all Narnia. Oh my! What if it's kind of like the White Witch? What if?
Yeah,
what
here's
if it's
what I'm
another
say.
Evil force like that.
Narnia
is as simple
is
as that.
Is its own world with its own histories and mythologies, and they don't always get things right. We know Jadis's, the White Witch's origins because of Charm, the story of the magician's nephew and Charm. We know how she got into that world. We know who brought her into Narnia.
But Mr. Beaver did not know that.
Mr. Beaver did not know that. And he says, here's a section from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Peter is asking Mr. Beaver, I mean, isn't the witch herself human? She'd like us to believe it, said Mr. Beaver. And it's on that she bases her claim to be queen. But she's no daughter of Eve. She comes of your father Adam's, here Mr. Beaver bowed, your father Adam's first wife. Her they called Lilith. And she was one of the djinn. That's what she comes from on one side. And on the other, she comes of the giants. No, no, there isn't a drop of real human blood in the witch. Well, we don't get anything remotely like that in the magician's nephew. I think obviously there's and even okay, you could argue about, you know, they are kind of biggish, giantish people, but what else are they supposed to say about someone who's really huge, you know, in the world of Narnia, a woman that tall? So I think that Narnia kind of builds up its own mythologies, and the owls don't know. They're kind of wondering, oh, two witches come to, you know, the
right
witches.
I really think, you look at it from the owl's perspective, what they would have meant by that, it's as simple as
Two witches come into Narnia.
Okay, there's this very mysterious lady who seems to have these, you know, magical powers.
And they're thinking, maybe they're part of the same crew.
Kidnapping the prince probably means she has some really serious plot against Narnia. Oh, what if she's kind of like the White Witch? What if she's that powerful? I really think that's all it is. I don't think it's supposed to mean anything more than that. JAF was kind of asking, you know, could she be the White Witch's daughter? What would raise the question?
Who's
the father? And of course, you know, the White Witch is, you know, magical and not even human. So who knows? Maybe there doesn't need to be a father. I don't know. Maybe there's some
leftover.
Don't
say that. They're going to do a big reveal. I am your father.
You are the father.
Sorry.
Maybe some leftover bit of magic somehow became Lady of the Green Kirtle. I don't know. Could it be? I suppose so. I don't think there's... It's hard to imagine how the Lady of the Green Kirtle could have gotten into Narnia from Charn. But then again, where did she come from? I simply don't know. And we'll never
know. I think that's a great... And here's the thing. If Lewis had died in a car crash, you know, at the right point or wrong point in his life, then we would have had the origin of no one. We would have had the Silver Chair, and that would have been the last book. It's great that we have the origin of the White Witch, but hey, I've spent more time wondering
if Lewis wanted to tell the origin of the Lady of the Green Kirtle, he certainly could have.
He could have. Wondered more about the origin of Tash, because he just kind of, I mean, it's just such a shocker that, you know, not to ruin it, but you know, you have false god, this idol, you know, this statue of Tash, and then all of a sudden you find out that it's actually, that he's real.
There actually is a
real Tash, and you think, oh my, and that's just, you know, and then of course what I find so amazing, you know, he follows Tyrion to the next world as well. So that I've spent more time wondering about Tash and any kind of origin story for him than I actually have the Lady of the Green Kirtle.
Yeah, so, I can see that.
So I think it's just one of those things where, you know, we got an origin story for one of the amazing villains and we didn't for the others. That's just kind of the way it worked out.
Yeah. But, you know, as mysterious as the origin of the Lady of the Green Kirtle is, her plot is actually just as mysterious. And we're going to probably kick off the next episode talking about that. And we got a couple questions about that.
As well as one of the greatest dialogue scenes in any of the Chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Certainly some of the best lines from guess who? The hero of the book.
Boy,
I'll give you a hint.
Your namesake.
But there's actually, even though we've reached the climax, there's still a lot more stuff to talk about with Lady of the Green Kirtle, you know, turning into a snake, and then finding Bolg and the gnomes and
Bizzum.
And then having to escape and the snow dance and Caspian's death and then him going to Aslan's country and
death of King Caspian and
he's
coming back to life.
So there's still a lot of stuff to talk about. And of course, just overall thoughts on the Silver Chair and maybe some thoughts on what they could do with it as a movie. So please continue to send in questions to podcast@arnieweb.com. We can't necessarily answer all of them, but we'll try to do as many as we can. And looking forward to... So I guess I'll say it again. We're going to wrap up the Silver Chair in the next one. But
that
if we get a million
theory.
More questions, we may have to stretch it out more. We'll get there. We will get to the end at some point.
Further up and further in.